Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He tells us high tech took it on the chin and the Russell 2000 was also challenged. He takes a look at crude and the Canadian dollar. InsideTrackTrading.com president Eric Haddock examines the cycles that overlay the stock markets, gold, the U.S. dollar, commodities, interest rates, and real estate. Founder of the website DollarCollapse.com, John Rubino, checks in from Port Angeles, Washington, to give us the lowdown on what the real rate of inflation could be, the U.S. housing bubble, unjustified government spending, and the weaponization of the American justice system. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, recycling trade publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Always good to be with you, Jim.
Ross, how are the stock markets looking?
A lot of red, and it started almost a week ago. Some of the stuff was getting a little bit tired. We look for decent overbought readings and then for a lack of follow-through, and that's pretty much what we've got. The S&P's got a pretty decent-looking roll right in here, and after, you know, pretty sizable rally out of that June bottom. The Russell 2000 has been clearly the leader on the upside, the best percentage gain off the bottom, and it generated some of our upside exhaustion alerts 4 days ago. And that type of thing, when you're still in a trend and you become overbought, it has far more believability in terms of how things might unfold. So in this case, overbought in longer term or intermediate term downtrends, one has to be very, very wary of that. And you know, even when you look at some of the, you know, the biggest names, the winners out there, Apple generated some sell signals here at 175. And this, you know, this bottomed with some of our weekly signals back in back in June at $130. So this has been a pretty sizable move for a big cap name like that. We've had 7 weeks on the sequential count. Typically, 9 weeks is the maximum that Apple likes to do. So it's probably getting ready to tire out here as well. And the ARK Innovation ETF, definitely, it's had the best run off a bottom, but definitely faltering. And I think you're looking at, you know, retest of the low, if not worse.
What's going on in the crude market?
Crude oil, it's just been grinding its way lower for the last, since $125 this spring. And not looking like it's been capable of taking out any resistance levels. The $90 level or 91 is the overhang at this point. And we had a decent rally in this week, but it hasn't been asked to take out any resistance levels. I think it's got a bit more basing to do before it's capable of rallying. The other item in the energy complex one wants to keep a really big eye on is natural gas. Typically, nat gas will have a seasonal low in the early part of August through the second week or so of September. Any pullback in here, and we're not getting one as of yet, but any pullback in here in nat gas, you want to be a buyer of not only the commodity, but also the stocks. Stocks like CNQ, over a million. Take a look at those ones on a correction. They probably have some pretty good size potential into October, November.
How's the Canadian dollar doing?
As we've been talking about here, stuck in a trading range. The top end of the range was tested a week ago, up around the 77.5 level. We are back down now towards support. You take a look at the agricultural commodities, the corn and wheat, and also, you know, oil moving down to $90 again. But the agricultural commodities are providing overhang, and they made new lows this week, coming off the high of the spring. And that has also put pressure on the Canadian. I think 76.5 is where you start to find support going forward here.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
You're more than welcome.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, Eric Haddock next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Eric Haddock, CEO and President of InsideTrackTrading.com. He's speaking to us from California. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Well, thanks for having me back, Jim.
Eric, can you tell us a little bit about InsideTrack and how people can subscribe, and maybe the story once again about why Inside is spelt just a little differently?
InsideTrack is a financial advisory service. Focusing on first and foremost futures markets, but the analysis and the cycles that pertain to those markets are equally applicable to stocks and bonds, currencies, metals, you name it. And so there's a broad spectrum of our readers and subscribers. We have different publications we offer, from things that are geared towards 3 to 5 day and 1 to 4 week traders, up to 1 to 3 year, 3 to 5 year investors. And a lot of the approach is from a cyclical and technical basis. Addressing your other comment about the spelling of Inside with the extra I in the middle, when I was first developing the newsletter, I wanted something, figured an acronym that would kind of capture the focal point of it. And that acronym of Inside turned out to, it stood for the markets that were addressed, from inflationary markets, which is all of your, commodities, to, stock indexes, interest rates, the dollar and other currencies, and energy markets. So the INSIDE stands for each of those market complexes. And that was brought together into the name, and so that's why the unique spelling of it. But the best place to find out more information is at our website, InsideTrackTrading.com. And again, it's spelled with the extra I in the middle, so it's INSIIDE, TrackTrading.com.
Eric, for stock markets, are the cycles showing a bull market or bear market as we head towards 2023?
Well, I guess a lot of that would determine on what time frame you're looking at and your definition of bull or bear markets. I think that we are still in a drawn-out topping phase, and the way I've described that for the last 2 years was that you have this very consistent 8-month cycle and 16-month cycle that are overlapping and being reinforced by a 2-year cycle and are also part of the culmination of a 40-year cycle. They all that there's this synergy that is coming into play in 2022-2023 where all of these cycles have been converging. And when you took it down to the 8-month cycle, what I was looking for was a series of 3 key tops that would create a topping phase. There'd be some divergence there, whereas you got to each subsequent high, certain stocks and indexes would still make it to higher highs, while a progressively larger group of stocks and indexes would be setting lower highs. And that is, I often correlate it to like an old wooden roller coaster where each car in the train of the roller coaster peaks at a different time, and it's not till the final car gets over the summit and over the peak that then the entire train declines rather rapidly. So this topping phase, I expected to see initial top in May-June of 2021, which we saw in a lot of the indexes. And you can still go back to a lot of stocks, and their peak was in that second quarter of 2021. The second peak, where I thought would be followed by a sharper decline, was in January of 2022, 8 months after that initial peak. And that was fulfilled very precisely, and we got the 3 to 6 month downtrend that I thought would follow that. And then a third peak where I think it's going to be even a smaller minority of stocks and indexes able to set new highs, is I'm looking for in September of 2022, so very soon. And I think after that is when you're going to be entering an even more precarious period in the markets. So from the bull or bear market perspective, you know, we saw a nice sell-off from January through June. And as I described back in June, I thought that that was the ideal timing for a bottom based on this 8-month cycle, because very often when a cycle progression, a tool that I use that you can find definitions and illustrations on our website. But when that is in the topping phase, the moves in between successive tops, so these successive tops I was expecting in early January and then in September of 2022, you will often see the decline in between them consume 2/3 of that cycle. And so in this case, that was about a 5.5 month decline that was expected, because then the ensuing rebound into the next peak will be approximately 50% of the time that the market declined. So you get a 5.5 month decline and then about a 2.75 month rebound, roughly speaking. And that comprises the overall 8-month period. And so for that to happen and to reinforce the analysis for a subsequent peak in September, the ideal scenario was to get a bottom in mid-June, which is exactly when the markets set their lows. And then in mid-July, on July 13th, I published the most significant buy signal that my work has triggered this year. Looking to enter the market on July 14th on a sell-off back to their early July lows. That was triggered very consistently with what that analysis was showing, and that was expected to trigger a strong advance into mid-August, but ultimately stretching into early to mid-September. So that's where we're at, and from my perspective, I think we're still going to see more upside, but on a short-term basis, we've kind of hit a peak and do a little bit of consolidation, but I think that's going to give way to another rally, and ultimately, like I said, this should stretch into September before another significant peak is seen.
Where is gold in its cycle?
Funny enough, gold has been, as far as its turning points, has been lagging the stock market by about a month or so. And from a broader perspective, it's been in a longer-term topping phase. And that was the result of a multi-year cycle and even a multi-decade cycle that I talked about with you for years, this 40-year cycle that I thought was going to trigger another multi-year advance in gold from late 2015 into late 2020, early 2021. We're now beyond that and in more of a volatile consolidation phase where gold has actually gone from its 2020 peak down to, which was around $2,080 to $2,100. It dropped down to roughly $1,680 and found major support there, and that was actually previous resistance that turned into support. So that 1680 was a level where some significant tops were set previously, and you look for them to provide some support on an initial sell-off. So gold dropped down to that 1680 level into March of 2021. Then it rallied into March of this year and retested the high around 2080 to 2100. And then saw a second decline right back to that 1680 level, which is, so we've seen what, if anyone familiar with Elliott Wave, that's considered a flat correction where you go from a high down to a low, back down to the same high and to the same low after that. So if you drew trend lines, you'd basically have two horizontal lines, one that connects the two peaks and one that connects the two lows, creating a flat correction. And since that time, gold has been in a little bit of a multi-month bullish phase that I think will result in a rally into September. But from gold's perspective, I think that it could be setting up for a series of successive highs that will also see two significant highs out in 2023 at some specific times that I've detailed, but that doesn't mean, especially in gold, doesn't mean that you're looking at a market going straight up. More likely what you'll see is, as we get closer to this September cycle high, you could see the biggest rally be just the final weeks before that peak and kind of a little bit of an accelerated advance into a high, just like we saw in early March of this year, just like gold has seen leading into most of its major peaks. And if that happens and we see a peak in the second half of September, most likely it would probably correct and consolidate for several months before doing something similar where you just get this multi-week surge that takes it up to new highs, takes it up to a subsequent cycle peak, and then it goes into this long drawn out consolidation phase. That's often what frustrates a lot of your gold and silver bulls, that they wait till the breakout, then they jump on the market, and that's it. Gold's already kind of expended its bullishness for that phase and that cycle. So then the market sells off and corrects for several months. The bullish traders get frustrated, finally clear out their positions, and then you see this 3 to 6 weeks, sometimes 2 to 4 weeks surge on, could be on some geopolitical news, some economic news, and the gold bugs jump back in, sure that it's now going up to $10,000 an ounce or something. And inevitably, that's the peak. And so you just get a progression like that in gold. You've seen it for many years, and I expect to see more of the same over the next 12 to 18 months.
What can be next for the U.S. dollar cycle?
My outlook for the dollar has really not changed in several years. And it's been in different phases of that expectation. The up and down cycles I thought we would see during this outlook. But the overall outlook has been very closely aligned with a approximate 3 to 3.25 year cycle that the dollar has adhered to for decades now, and so often the lows are separated by 38 to 41 months, and the highs are separated by a similar interval. And so we had our rally up into early 2017, and then a sell-off into early 2018. Then you had another rally back up to the same highs. It was a little bit like this flat correction I just talked about with gold. The dollar peaked at about the same level in 2020, a little over 3 years after its previous peak, then sold off into early 2021, a little over 3 years from its previous low. From there, I thought and continue to think we would see a final rally in the dollar into early 2023. And so that's the phase of my long-term outlook that we're in now. And if you look at the dollar since 2008, the dollar index, I should specify, that it has been in a what's now a broad multi-year five-wave advance from that 2008 bottom. The fifth wave, which is usually your culminating wave, began with the early 2021 lows, and I think it's going to peak in the first half of 2023, and we may have seen the majority of its up move already, because my primary upside target for the whole advance was the dollar index getting up to 110, maybe as high as 113, and recently we got up to 109, so very close to that major upside target. When something like that happens and those targets are reached or almost reached with still several months to go in the overall cycle, basically one of two things happens. Either I'm wrong on one of the two aspects, the price target or the cycle, or the market is still going to adhere to the upside price target and the upside cycle high target, which means if it's already seen 90% of that upside price objective or potential, now it's got to enter a consolidation phase, see a drawn-out correction, and then give a final spike high towards the end of the cycle. So when the dollar got up to 109 and there were intermediate cycles saying we should see a top, that told me that the dollar was most likely going to enter a drawn-out, what could be a 3 to 6 month consolidation phase. An initial range I thought would be between 105 and 109 on the dollar index. And if it can break below 105 at some point in the next couple of weeks, then it could drop back to about 101. But staying in that overall range for several months, and then as we come into early 2023, as long as it has held that support around 101, I think that the dollar index will make a final surge, and that could be the end of the bull run in the dollar, and that could have some very different or diverse ramifications for the 1, 2, 3 years that follow that, especially once a top is in, you do some of a topping phase, and then it begins to turn down with a little more vigor, maybe in late 2023 or early 2024. That could have a lot of different ramifications on many markets, whether they be inflationary markets, interest rate markets, even stock markets. But that's a kind of a broader long-term thing that I'm not putting a lot of my focus on right now, because there's a lot of other things in between now and then that I think traders need to be aware of.
Is the commodity cycle dependent on the U.S. dollar cycle?
In many respects, it is. But you're talking about a correlation there, and any time that I start to discuss or respond to questions about intermarket correlation between one market and another, I kind of preface that discussion with my axiom of market correlation. And in my trading manual, my tech tip reference library, I have a series of axioms of trading that I think are very important for traders to understand, to internalize, and not to underestimate. Some of them may even sound a little pithy on the surface, but they're more profound than you realize if you really keep them in context and keep them as a foundation for your trading. And my axiom of market correlation states that markets only follow other markets when the lead market is going parabolic or is in an extreme phase. Also, correlations are only effective when you, the trader, can be certain, absolutely certain, of the current focus of traders. So let me just unpack that a little bit. And what I'm saying there and what I've seen to be true so often is that when you get traders that are trying to trade one market based on a correlation to another market, 80 to 90% of the time, that just results in frustration. Because when those two different markets are just in your normal day-to-day, the next day it's not. So let me give you an example. What we'll talk about when you talk about commodities and the dollar. Well, in theory, and through the last 30, 40 years, on a broad basis, a weaker dollar usually results in higher commodity prices, since those commodities that we're talking about, at least when we're talking about from a U.S.-based perspective, those commodities are priced in dollars. So if the dollar is weakening, it takes more of those dollars to equal the same commodity. It's not even necessarily commodities going up in value. It's that it's interchange, it's exchange into dollars is gaining because the value of the dollar is dropping. That's a very general and basic correlation. But if you try to trade that on a day-to-day basis, if you're looking at, you know, the dollar's had a sharp sell-off today, and you're buying wheat and corn because you're sure they have to go up on the weaker dollar, well, there can be supply and demand factors in those grains. There can be shipping factors. There can be a dozen or more other fundamentals that are having more of an immediate and urgent impact on those grain markets than their correlation to the dollar. Same thing with dollar and gold. You know, often I'll get traders and I'll talk about where I've got analysis that says the dollar should go up into this time frame and pretty much gold should go up into a similar time frame. And they'll say, well, that's impossible. The two can't go up together. Well, I can cite you and I can show you charts of numerous examples where 80%, 90% of a move, the dollar and gold move in sync. And they may have topped at slightly different times, bottomed at slightly different times, but they moved in lockstep when you're looking at the chart and you're looking at a 6 to 12 month trend, even though the general textbook correlation is that that can't happen because you're talking about gold based in or priced in dollars, so you can't have the two going up at the same time. Well, there's reasons why you can, and I've explained that to many readers many times because I often get hit with that argument. And so, you know, long answer to your simple question, I definitely think that when the dollar is in a parabolic phase, a more extreme phase, yes, it has a strong impact on commodities and vice versa. But when you're in more of the day-to-day, like recently with the dollar kind of topping out and going sideways, that has little to no impact on commodities. At that point, commodities will just be trading on their own fundamentals, their own governing factors, whatever the factor of the day might be. And that's where I get back to that final caveat about the focus of traders that, you know, you could have one news item comes up today and that becomes the central focus. So all these other things, all these correlations and other fundamental factors just go out the window for that day at least. So if you're trying to trade on them, you're going to be behind the eight ball. So it's important not to put too much weight on those intermarket correlations except from a very general and broad perspective.
Within the interest rate cycle, do rates tend to move significantly higher towards the end of the cycle?
Interest rates aren't always as much like that as some markets like gold. When I was just talking about gold, as it gets close to a cycle high, will often have 80 or 90% of its move during that last 10 or 20% of the cycle. I actually described that in my 90-10 rule of cycle with certain markets. Certain markets are very indicative or very consistent with that pattern. Interest rates are not as much. They will move more in equal or proportional percentages throughout the whole cycle. And often with interest rates, the biggest part is more in the middle of the cycle, which is where I think we've been the last year. There's a very consistent four-year cycle in interest rates and in bonds that was projecting a major top in mid-2020, and 4 years later, a successive lower top in mid-2024. Well, now, interpreting that by interest rates, that would mean a major low in interest rates in mid-2020 and a secondary low in mid-2024, since bonds and interest rates are inverse. So within that four-year cycle, kind of like what I was talking about with stocks, that you will often see the market move. So in this case, the decline from that top in bonds or the advance from that bottom in interest rates will consume roughly two-thirds of that four-year cycle. So in interest rates, if about two-thirds of that four-year period, I would expect to be the uptrend in interest rates. So my outlook all along has been that interest rates would move higher from mid-2020 into the first half of 2023. And then they would drop back for roughly half of the amount of time that they advanced. And that will take you into that four-year cycle low, albeit a little bit higher low that I'm expecting in mid-2024. Within that two and three quarter year uptrend in interest rates, the bigger part of the move in interest rates is typically in the middle of that cycle. And that's what we have seen this year in 2022, which is kind of the center third of that two and a half to two and three quarter year period. And then you'll get the final moves as the interest rate hike cycle starts to wane and the Fed starts to get less aggressive, less hawkish, and they start to be concerned with, these interest rate hikes have started to curtail economic activity. We better not push the market too much more. So you get the biggest parts of those interest rate moves in the middle of the cycle. And I think that and I'm not alone here, I'm kind of reflecting what the masses are thinking in this case, that we've seen kind of the extreme of the interest rate hike cycle, that the next hike could be the same or slightly less than the most recent one, and from there it's likely to the increase will be less each time, even though the rates are continuing to go higher. It's that momentum will start to turn, and that should lead into the end of that interest rate cycle in early 2023.
Does real estate have a separate cycle, or does it tend to react to the interest rate cycle?
I think that it's some of both. And it definitely has its own cycle. And going back to my axiom of market correlation, when interest rates are in a more extreme or accelerated phase, then the correlation to real estate becomes more consistent, more pronounced, higher correlation between the two. And often you'll get, and stocks do this too, you'll get real estate and stocks pretty much ignoring the first 70-80% of interest rate hikes. In those cases, it's because stocks or real estate, and I hope I said that real estate and stocks are similar, that they're leading this move. So economic activity's been, on the rebound since mid-2020. And stocks are going up, eventually real estate came along with it, and then interest rates are reacting to that. As you get towards the end of that cycle, you've seen the real estate and the stock market leading, and then all of a sudden interest rates will pass this point where everyone's looked at them as, okay, they're necessary evil. They're not yet going to negatively impact stock market or real estate value, and then it's often on a dime that that whole perception changes 180 degrees. And a perfect example of this, you have to go back a few decades, but was in the mid-80s, where stocks were heading up and bonds were heading up along with them. And then in about mid-85, bonds started to top out, so interest rates started to bottom. They kind of stayed there through most of 85. Then in 86, stocks kept going higher. Interest rates started to edge up along with stocks. And stocks just kept, you know, the reason interest rates were going up was because economic activity was still bullish and the outlook was still bullish, so stocks kept going up. And that kept happening. In fact, if you look at a bond chart and look at how precipitous the drop in bonds was during the final 8 to 12 months of that cycle, and yet stocks kept going up, and then stocks peaked in late August, kind of were hovering there. Mid-October, you had this final spike down in bonds, so spike up in interest rates, and then like someone had shut off a light switch, all of a sudden stocks had a completely different perspective of what that interest rate, those higher interest rates meant. No longer was it this is good because the interest rates are reacting to the strong economy. All of a sudden it was, this is bad for stocks. And you had your October crash in stocks, and immediately interest rates started dropping in reaction to the stocks that were reacting to the interest rates. But it was all at the very end of the cycle, and you've seen that many times over, and I wouldn't be surprised to see it again, where stocks and real estate are in this topping phase now, and the interest rate hikes are a necessary evil that, you know, each time they happen, there's a little bit of a blip where stocks and real estate might retrench a little bit. But then inevitably they start back on their the latter stages of their bull market, and maybe towards the end of this year, maybe early next year, you get that final interest rate. Maybe it's not even an actual hike by the Fed, but the bonds are selling off again, and the expectation for another hike is built in, and all of a sudden you could see the stock market and perhaps real estate react more negatively and more significantly to that final notch up in interest rates. And that's the type of thing, the type of correlation, that's the extreme phase that I'm talking about in that axiom of market correlation, that I wouldn't be surprised to see where real estate and even the stock market is concerned sometime out in 2023.
Are predictions tougher for shorter-term, medium-term, or long-term cycles?
Ooh, that's a good one, because if you're factoring in a proportional range of error or leeway, then they're pretty similar. But if you're looking at shorter-term cycles, you know, a one-day range of error, if you're one day early or late in getting in or out of a market, that might be the equivalent of, you know, 1 month in a 6 month cycle or 3 months in a 2 year cycle. So the cycles have similar proportional leeway, range of error, whatever you want to call it, but it sometimes has sharper ramifications depending on which one you're trading and which one you're really focused on. And I should also say that even though a lot of my discussions revolve around cycles, they're more a little bit easier thing to discuss without having a lot of my charts and other illustrations along with me. But cycles I view as the backdrop. They're the foundation. They're the setting the stage. Once I get that in place, then I have much more subjective and risk management-oriented technical indicators that start to hone my focus and filter those cycles and give me more specific approaches and ultimately trading strategies And the most important part of those trading strategies is identifying where I'm wrong, and so where it's time to get out and say, okay, live to fight another day. So those things are ultimately far more important to me than the cycles themselves, and they need to corroborate the cycles, particularly when you are talking about broader cycles that have a larger range of error. So those are the things that I really focus on. But getting back to your primary question, I think that in some respects it's easier, or you have a little greater accuracy rate with the broader, longer-term cycles because there's more room for error. But ultimately, from a difficulty standpoint, they're probably pretty equal.
Eric, where can people follow you and subscribe to Inside Track?
Well, I would just, again, refer them to our primary website at InsideTrackTrading.com. That's with the extra I in the middle, INSIIDE, TrackTrading.com. And we have a lot of archived articles, reports, examples of our publication for anyone that wants to get a feel for what we produce. There's also information on a lot of the indicators that I refer to and how to track them, and illustrations of what they look like and some of the nuances of them. So we try to make it very educational as well. But all the information that any listener would want to try and make an informed decision, they can find at InsideTrackTrading.com.
Eric, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me again, Jim. It's always a pleasure.
My guest has been Eric Haddock, CEO and President of InsideTrackTrading.com. He was speaking to us from Central California. Coming up, John Rubino next on This Week in Money.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. He's speaking to us from Port Angeles, Washington. Welcome back to This Week in Money, John.
Hey, Jim.
John, the U.S. reported its latest inflation number last week. Was it 8% or 0%?
Well, the background for that question being meaningful is that the U.S. government has been lying to us for quite a while. You know, they redefined vaccine because what they were trying to get us to take didn't fit the previous definition, and then they redefined recession because by the normal definition of recession, we were in one, and they didn't want to admit it, so they changed the definition, and now they're kind of sort of doing the same thing with inflation. We had inflation that was up 8% year over year, the most recent CPI number, Consumer Price Index. But it was up 0% sequentially month over month. So they latched on to the 0% and said, hey, we have 0% inflation now, when that's probably not the best way to define it, because monthly numbers contain a lot of statistical noise. So you can't really trust sequential monthly numbers very much at all. But the year-over-year number is much more trustworthy because it contains an awful lot of data between here and a year ago. And so, yeah, you know, the U.S. has seen inflation over the past year. In other words, the dollar has lost value over the past year by about 8%, according to official statisticians. So let's stay with that number for now and ignore what our government is saying.
Are they more honest in England? The central bank there saying the inflation rate in Britain is running at 13%, and they say it's likely to go as high as 17 8%. Is it just because they're paying so much more for energy because of the Russia-Ukraine conflict?
Well, part of, you know, energy is a huge component of the inflation indexes. So that could be part of it. And then there are food issues that have to do with supply chains and weather and things like that that vary from place to place. And that could be part of it, too. Or, like you said, it could just be honesty. It could be they're telling the truth and we are not, you know, and that's how they get the higher number. But, you know, in any event, whether it's 8% or whether it's 13%, this is catastrophic inflation, you know, and were it to continue, it would basically just be the downfall of this civilization. You know, you can't run that kind of inflation for very long without the system just breaking down. So we better hope that it's transitory and not permanent.
Home sales and prices seem to be rolling over in the U.S. Has the bubble finally burst?
It looks like it has. We had a over the past year a really spectacular housing market where there were bidding wars everywhere, and you know your asking price became the point for negotiating upwards rather than from negotiating downwards, and it just became one of those bubble markets, you know, and which is kind of strange because the last bubble in the U.S. was a housing bubble, and normally you don't have the same bubble blowing up again after it collapsed just a decade before because people still remember it. But apparently we forgot very quickly here in the U.S. So, but anyhow, yes, it does seem to be rolling over now. Prices just got to the point where affordability was non-existent. People just couldn't afford to buy the house they wanted. And so they started to pull back. And then the people who were kind of on the fence about selling but wanted to hold on and see if it went up by another 20%, they're kind of panic dumping houses on the market right now. So we're seeing the supply of houses for sale go through the roof, the number of deals getting done plunge, and mortgage demand plunge. So, yeah, I think you can say with a fair degree of certainty that the housing bubble has burst. Now the question is, what does the bust look like? And I think it could be fairly brutal. Probably not like the last time around because there were a lot of derivatives involved in the housing market last time, and it doesn't seem like that's the case this time. So we could see, you know, sales fall, prices drop back down to a reasonable level. A lot of real estate brokers get thrown out of work and things like that, but not something that's systemically threatening in the housing market this time around. But it'll still be ugly for anybody who's exposed to it.
What level of inflation should we expect going forward?
Well, that's the big question because a lot of things besides housing have rolled over. You know, energy is down, or at least oil is down in the U.S. from about $130 a barrel USD at the peak of this cycle, and it's down in the 80s right now. So that was a pretty big drop. So you combine home prices falling with oil prices falling, and that kind of leads to the expectation that going forward, inflation is not going to be as extreme as it has been. So we may drop from, you know, in terms of official numbers, which take them for a grain of salt, but those are the ones that we'll see, from the current 8 to 9%, maybe down to 4 or 5%, because we still got food inflation, and there's a lot of shortages of other things. So there will be other things going up, while a couple of big things like houses and oil either stay where they are now or go down further from here. So I would think that the headline inflation numbers won't be as scary in the year ahead as they are now, but the cost of living for a lot of people, since prices are not overall going to go back down anytime soon, it doesn't look like, so people are still going to be burdened by extremely high prices, which means they won't be able to buy as much stuff because they're still trying to put, you know, gas in the car and pay the rent and buy food. So that probably means a slowing economy overall, just because consumer spending is so important to us here in the U.S., and if consumers have to pull back because they're hurting because of high prices in certain sectors, then, you know, the economy should be slower, which should also be a negative for inflation. and a negative for a lot of other things. You know, we have a midterm election coming up, and our poor government, you know, those guys all want to get reelected. But they're having trouble, I think, deciding whether they want to go into that election with raging inflation or a recession and people being thrown out of work. And either one of those is still possible right now, and I think they hate the idea of either one of those things, but they're kind of being forced to choose in terms of what policies they adopt for here on in. And you know what? Couldn't happen to a nicer bunch of sociopaths.
How much more tightening is the Fed likely to do from here?
Well, they still feel like they need to do some more tightening, even though oil is down, houses are down, like I said. And there's also a lot of layoffs going on out there, especially in big tech, but also in retail. So the Fed is seeing indications that the economy might be moderating and inflation might not be raging like it was the past year in the next couple of years. But this inflation was a wake-up call that we're creating insane amounts of new currency, we're messing with the global supply chains, we're picking fights with everybody in the world, we're doing things that lead to higher prices, but it cannot be allowed to continue. The prices cannot be allowed to continue to go up like this. So the Fed knows it needs to raise interest rates some more here. So I think the next meeting, which is, what, a month and a half away, we'll definitely see another rate increase. And then after that, all bets are off. So, you know, the Fed capitulation that we've been waiting for might not be that far out. Or maybe they have more of a backbone, or they're more panicked by recent inflation than we think they are, and they'll continue to raise rates. There's no way to know, because these are decisions that are being made by people who are absolutely clueless about economics. They're operating with flawed models that don't tell them anything about where the world is going, and they're under a huge amount of political pressure. So take inadequate people with bad information and a lot of pressure, and there's no way to know what they're going to do. And that's our situation now with the Fed in the U.S. They could do any number of incredibly stupid things going forward, but it's impossible to guess or to predict which stupid things in particular they'll choose to do.
The U.S. just passed a massive spending bill. What are the implications?
Think about that. We just finished a year in which inflation was 8% and change. And these guys are coming up with giant spending bills, which will require huge amounts of new government debt, huge amounts of new currency creation, on the heels of near double-digit inflation. So I think I mentioned just now how stupid the people running our country are, and this is a good example of that. They have no idea how the world works, and they only have this one tool, which is big spending plans and massive money creation. So they're just going to keep doing what they've been doing going forward because it's all they know how to do. The effects of this thing will be, I think you can almost guarantee, they'll be different from what the government hopes they will be. All that it actually means, to answer your question, is that we don't have any idea what we're doing here in the U.S. We're just going to make mistake after mistake until the system breaks, and this is an example of it.
Are there currently a number of big risks happening in the world?
Yeah, all around the world, crazy things are happening. We're seeing a spread of civil unrest through the developing world. For instance, Argentina was just the headline today. They've got thousands and thousands of people in the street over inflation. And that's destabilizing in each of these countries. And it's also destabilizing globally, because a lot of the countries that are now looking at, you know, civil unrest leading to regime change, leading to unknowable policy changes, they're parts of these supply chains that we depend on. And if they break because of something that's happening specifically in, say, Argentina or Brazil or Colombia or wherever, if they break there, that makes it harder for everybody else to get these supply chains back up and running, and raises prices and leads to shortages, which leads to more civil unrest, which leads to even more broke supply chains. So that, you know, we've got things that are vicious cycles going out there going on out there that aren't really leading to any place good. And meanwhile, the U.S. is blundering around the world picking fights with everybody in sight. You know, we expanded NATO, Russia, right to Russia's border, and of course they responded as they promised they would by invading somebody, and they picked Ukraine. And then meanwhile, we've got China saying that, you know, U.S. officials should not be going to Taiwan, and we keep sending officials there, you know, and China's liable to respond pretty much the way Russia did, and none of this has to happen, but it is apparently happening because we don't know how to control ourselves in the U.S. That, of course, will also break supply chains and possibly lead to something a lot worse than broken supply chains, because Russia and China are nuclear powers. So, you know, not taking their interests into account, even if their interests are unreasonable in a lot of cases, is dangerous, because these guys have the ability to wipe out human life. And so we really need to be more careful in the U.S., and we're not. Again, because we're stupid. You know, the guys in charge are just an embarrassment. And it doesn't look like it's going to get any better as elections flush out a few of them and replace them with other people who are equally unstable and clueless. So the rest of the world, you can look at the domestic economy wherever you are, but you have to include what's happening in the rest of the world in your analysis, because a lot of those things are very important and potentially very dangerous, and they're multiplying rather than diminishing as we speak.
Gold and silver are bouncing off their recent bottoms. Why is this happening, and what does it mean?
Well, they got badly oversold, for one thing. And I think a lot of people were expecting raging inflation to lead to higher interest rates, to lead to Fed tightening at the short end of the yield curve, and to the economy tanking. And that led them to look elsewhere than gold and silver for protection from all of this, because those things are generally seen as inflation hedges. And if a slowing economy is going to lead to slowing inflation, maybe you don't need gold and silver right away, but, you know, the Fed is going to capitulate at some point and go back to easing. And that's when precious metals will take off, if the past is still prologue. We saw that in 2008. We saw it in 2020, where gold and silver got whacked along with stocks as people started worrying about deflation. But as soon as the Fed jumped in and started printing money like crazy, precious metals took off. And that day is coming. So I think nothing that's happened lately would lead you to stop your dollar cost averaging in precious metals and the highest quality mining stocks. Because as gold and silver start to go back up, of course, their prices will rise, but so will the miners and everything. So I think, you know, this isn't a bad time to be buying these things, and it's definitely not a time to stop your dollar cost averaging if that's what you're doing. You know, you should just be ignoring the market, the market for gold and silver and the mining stocks, and just putting your regular monthly amount into those things. That's a lot more restful, and it gives you a good average price when the time comes. And the final thing about gold and silver is that we're heading into the positive seasonal time. Usually towards the end of the year, buying pressure from Asia pushes the price of gold and silver up, and that takes the miners up. So we're almost out of the summer doldrums, and we're heading back into the positive time. So even if all the rest of the world wasn't doing all the crazy stuff it was doing, this would be a pretty good time for gold and silver. So I think that explains part of why they're up a little bit lately from their lows.
The FBI raided the home of ex-President Trump. Is this justified or another example of the weaponization of the U.S. legal system?
Well, we're turning into a banana republic, to put it bluntly, where, you know, in these third world countries that we tend to look down on here in the developed world, they send the police after their political enemies, and, you know, the government thinks nothing of framing some other politician who looks like a threat and putting them in jail for one thing or another. We're doing that now. You know, Trump came along and just broke the deep state in the U.S. These guys are so desperate to get rid of him that they will do anything, and they've gone after him for meaningless things over and over again, and this looks like another one of those where you know, the FBI has never raided an ex-president's house, ever, in the history of the country. And you hear Trump has been out of office for such a long time that it's inconceivable that he could be doing anything damaging to anybody. And yet they decided that they want to, okay, here's the two possibilities for their motivation. One is that they're morons, which, you know, I buy into that explanation, but they're so terrified of Trump, they want to try and get rid of him, and they think weaponizing the justice system in the U.S. is a way to do it, when in fact, it's highly likely to energize his base and actually make him a more formidable candidate next time around. You know, it increases the odds of President Trump 2.0 in a couple of years. If the deep state is smarter than we generally give them credit for, it could be that they're trying to accomplish what I just outlined as a way of keeping Florida's governor Ron DeSantis from being able to run, because they see him as a more formidable candidate. Now that would actually be kind of a smart political move if that's what they're doing. I don't think they have the emotional maturity to think through something like that anymore, but that could be what it is. But anyhow, it's bad, it's ugly, it's embarrassing, and we'll see how it plays out, but I can't imagine this ending in a way that makes people in other countries look at us and think, well, America's a well-run country. Yeah, that's, we've lost that opportunity, you know. It's only which way did we screw up and make a fool of ourselves this time around.
Do you like any of the junior stock sectors at the moment?
Well, the junior miners, the highest quality junior miners, let me be really clear about that qualification, look pretty good right now. And by high quality, I mean serious ounces in the ground, a good management team, rock solid finances so they can spend the next year exploring and building up a resource without having to go out for financing in an unfavorable market. Those guys look pretty good. And a lot of the weaker junior mining stocks, that especially the ones that need large amounts of financing now. I saw an interview with Rick Rule the other day where he's saying, yeah, they're finally willing to talk to us now, because he and his company drive a really hard bargain with the juniors. And in good times, when they can borrow money or sell equity on any other terms, they don't want to talk to him. But now they're coming around talking to him because the terms are terrible otherwise out there. So you really don't want to be involved with these companies that are desperately trying to get financing on Rick Rule's terms. So you want to just stick with the high-quality ones. But those guys, they look good.
John, anything else that you think we should be keeping a real close eye on right now that other people aren't talking about?
Well, I think the danger that I see now, which goes a little deeper than just over a banana republic picking on politicians, is that lying and weaponizing the judicial and criminal justice system, they're becoming so embedded in the U.S. where the corporate media basically just parrots what the intelligence community and the political class tell them. And, you know, you go to CNN or someplace like that, and it's all, oh, now we're going to bring on our commentator who's an ex-CIA agent. You know, that stuff should never happen in the media. You know, you should never hang out with ex-FBI agents and ex-CIA agents as your color commentary, you know. And that's where we are now. So this is a really dangerous time for the U.S. It looks like we're being captured. And by the way, for Canada, you guys are not escaping this. You're kind of drifting into some kind of fascist dystopia, too. So I think we really need to be careful about steps in that direction. And we really, really need to be coming back from that abyss, because this is a terrifying situation here. And, you know, we can still stop it. We can still go back to being a constitutional country of laws, but we're a long way from that now. And that's the thing that really scares me, that all of these things that we think of as normal just stop being normal, and we just drift into some kind of a dictatorship here. And then, you know, markets don't matter very much because they'll be manipulated too. And it gets very hard to invest correctly in a country where the government is basically a giant predator looking at you. Oh, you know, okay, the thing I forgot to mention is that we just signed a bill to hire 87,000 new IRS agents. This is kind of the thing that has me most scared, because the help wanted ad they put up for those 87,000 jobs included lines like, must be competent to carry a gun and must be willing to use deadly force. This is for our IRS agents, you know, for the accountants that tell you you didn't take this deduction correctly. You know, they're going to apparently prepare to break down your door and just do whatever they feel like. So we're building kind of a private police force in the U.S. or, you know, private government police force, something like the Praetorian Guard or the KGB or something like that. This scares me. So I think we should all be paying attention and doing what we can to stop it.
John, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Sure thing, Jim.
My guest has been John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Eric Haddock, and John Rubino. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.